doesn't want to do nasty things, but must do them. It can be a most moving performance. If we have any time at all to spare from Hamlet's dilemmas, we can be moved by Claudius. Shakespeare had written about this situation a number of times before, the usurping king and what happens to him. The most brilliant earlier example is Bolingbroke, who turns into King Henry IV and must cope with the results of his own usurpation. And one of the results is what the usurper does to himself. Shakespeare's breadth of vision is enough to take in Claudius as well as Hamlet. But, of course, the play does chiefly focus upon Hamlet. I'm not rewriting it as the tragedy of Claudius, but I must move on to Gertrude before I turn to Hamlet. Gertrude is more difficult. It is a distinctly underwritten part. We wonder how much Gertrude knows of what her new husband has done, how much has gone on behind the scenes. It is an ambiguity in the play whether Gertrude slept with Claudius before her first husband died. The ghost says that Claudius won the seeming virtue of my queen, but it isn't absolutely explicit whether this was an adultery before the murder or just a seduction prior to the marriage after the murder. How much does she know? She clearly does not know that her second husband killed her first. She seems to be utterly astonished when Hamlet, in the closet scene, says, "As bad a deed, good mother, as kill a king and marry with his brother." Her response is, "As kill a king? Who's been killing kings around here?" The best suggestion I've had about the part of Gertrude came from an actor friend of mine, quite a distinguished actor, Austin Pendleton, who said to me, "I think it's a movie part, not a stage part. It's the kind of part in which a movie actress, without lines, can make all sorts of points because of the close-up camera, because Shakespeare didn't give her enough lines." And I think that is borne out in two other performances that I will mention. One is the performance of Glenn Close in the Zeffirelli version of Hamlet, the one that stars Mel Gibson. It is not Glenn Close's best performance. She's done many better movies. But the final scene she's very good at. When she drinks the poisoned cup and realizes it is poisoned, she has a series of silent recognitions. She looks at Hamlet and realizes the poison must have been intended for him. She looks at Claudius and realizes that's where the poison must have come from. You can read on her face how she replays this whole story from the very beginning, from the death of her first husband, in the last 30 seconds of her life. Gertrude's realization, done without words, as a close-up camera effect, is a marvelous thing. Even better, I think, is the performance of Julie Christie as Gertrude in the film Maid of Hamlet Kenneth Branagh. The bedroom scene. Julie Christie's Gertrude had been enjoying her second marriage. She has many new clothes. She has a new gown and a new hairdo every scene she appears in. She is genuinely fond of her second husband, of Claudius, played in this case by Derek Jacobi, grown older. She is affectionate toward her son, but she's clearly taken up with the whirl and excitement of having a new husband, of still being queen of Denmark, enjoying things being so prosperous. Until we get to the closet scene, and her son starts raging against her and killing Polonius and leaving the body there in a huge pool of blood, and she retreats onto the bed. And Julie Christie does this most marvelous thing of trying to sort out what's happening here and realizing that she is partly at fault. She has not been thinking of the last couple of weeks from Hamlet's point of view. She has been worried about Hamlet being mad, but it hadn't occurred to her before that she might be partly at fault. Her own behavior. She has failed in some way as a mother. She goes through one of those things that most mothers go through, most good mothers go through, when their children start misbehaving. Did I do something wrong? Did I provoke this? Was the way I brought up this kid misdirected in some way? These are moving moments that actresses can do. The script provides the room for it. It doesn't provide the firm direction for it. It must be the actress and the director who creates this with Gertrude. Let me go back to Hamlet himself. Hamlet is a young intellectual, I have been saying. He has been trying to cope with a set of appalling circumstances. Circumstances for most of which he is not responsible. After all, the initial trouble in the play is the murder of his father, and he didn't cause that. His ideas have proved inadequate to guide him. Let me lay particular stress on his youth. If King Lear is the story, the tragedy of old age, the tragedy of a man who must let go and doesn't know how to let go, and Macbeth is the tragedy of a man in middle life, the man of some achievement in the world, he's achieved a position, he's settled, he's married, he's at the point where a man begins to wonder, is this it? Is this all I am going to achieve? Should I be satisfied with where I am? If Lear is about old age, if Macbeth is about middle years, then Hamlet certainly is young. And he suffers from a difficulty characteristic of intelligent young people. How to coordinate with one's ideas with one's feelings. The people who complain that they don't understand Hamlet at all simply haven't been around college students enough. Hamlet is available to you in quantity on any university campus. Like most university students, Hamlet is stuffed with ideas. Ideas from his education, ideas from his upbringing, ideas from his own reflection. But the famous 19th century image of Hamlet as a prince paralyzed by thought, Coleridge's prince who just wants to think and not act, is only half true. He's also very passionate, very impulsive. His opening encounter with the ghost shows his ideas being violently displaced by his emotions. And his brushing Horatio aside, saying, I'll make a ghost of anyone who stands in my way. I'm going to talk to that apparition. For every thoughtful soliloquy he utters, he has a blaze of rash, fierce riot stemming from the emotions that rage within him. He rages at his girlfriend, rages at his mother, stabs a sword through an arras to kill Polonius without even bothering to find out who's behind that arras. Stealing the letter from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and forging a replacement which will send them to their deaths, fighting pirates, interrupting his own production of the Mousetrap play with rude remarks. As we say now, Hamlet cannot get his act together. It is deeply significant that he has two enormous speeches of praise for other people, and they praise exactly opposite qualities. He praises the player for his ability to express emotion with the utmost of freedom, that the player, in talking about Queen Hecuba, wept himself. Oh, that man can really let it all out, really let it go. Some 10 minutes later, he praises Horatio for being a Stoic. All passions hit you, but you do not become passion's slave. I like a man like that. Let me wear such a man in my heart of hearts. Both free expression and firm self-control earn his admiration. That, I think, is why he's so mixed up about Ophelia. I don't have time to talk about Ophelia in detail, to talk about Ophelia from her own point of view, and that's unfair. But from Hamlet's point of view, he's deeply conflicted between two opposite positions. One he expresses when she's dead, when he's quarreling with Laertes over the grave. I loved Ophelia. 40,000 brothers could not with their quantity of love make up a sum like mine. Ah, there's never been any such love in the world of young man for young woman. And yet earlier in the nunnery scene, the moment he suspected that she might be the tool of her father and the king in getting at him, he abused her as a painted whore. You jig, you amble, you lisp. Now, this is clearly not what we call a mature relationship. She is either the most important person on earth, the most wonderful girl that ever was, or she's a traitor. Now, I think you've seen young people go back and forth about their emotional commitment to a romantic object in that way. Everything's either wonderful or she let me down, and she isn't worth a moment of my thought. His own, which is to say that this doesn't have much to do with Ophelia. It's his own emotions that aren't very reliable. They're extremely forceful, but they're continually changing, and they're continually being undercut by his own intellect. One of the stunning examples of that occurs when, in one of the soliloquies, when he's expressing his anger at Claudius, having seen how emotional the player could get, he bursts out in a similar rage about Claudius. This is the way I should be talking about Claudius. It cannot be but that I am pigeon-livered and lack gall to make oppression bitter, or ere this I would have fatted all the region kites with this slave's offal. Bloody, bawdy villain, remorseless, lecherous, treacherous, kindless villain, all vengeance! Oh, what an ass am I? This is most brave, that I, the son of a dear father murdered, must unpack my heart with words like a very whore. Now, it's that emotional break that I'm interested in. There's a very great deal of Hamlet in that. The anger at Claudius was genuine. I don't think an actor can play that as fake. You've got to throw yourself into it. Bloody, bawdy, villain, remorseless, treacherous, lecherous, kindless villain. But it is, and the great cry at the end, oh, vengeance, when Hamlet usually grabs a sword and waves it. At the same time, it is equally genuine for him to turn around and say, oh, what an ass am I. I'm behaving like a character in a play, one of these old-fashioned revenge plays where they hurl themselves around and chop off people's hands and are totally unconvincing. Hamlet rants, and the rant is genuine, but such is the quicksilver quality of human feeling that after a couple of lines of rant, he perceives the rant to be rant and sneers at it. Hamlet cannot maintain his own view, not until he takes the trip to England, the aborted trip to England. When he comes back from that adventure, then he is stabler. I think the way to sum this up is to go back to Wittenberg, to that Protestant university, Protestant humanist university, that I started with. Hamlet the play and Hamlet the man are pervaded by a kind of intellectual doubt, characteristic of the Protestant Reformation. In the Catholic Middle Ages, the voice of God was heard clearly. God was knowable. Not totally known, of course, human beings can't totally know God, but sufficiently well known so that moral action can be straightforward. When the medieval mystery plays dramatized the sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham had no problem. Abraham is ordered to sacrifice his son. He's got an emotional problem, of course. He doesn't want to do it. But he doesn't have an intellectual problem. He knows perfectly well that he must do it, that obedience to God is more important than paternal love. When the Protestant Reformation did away with all the intermediaries between God and men, when it did away with the hierarchy of the church offering an authoritative interpretation of the Word of God, it left individuals alone with a limited ability to respond to a God who is not clearly known. Protestants believe in God's grace, but the principles by which grace operated were disputed in the Reformation. Insoluble moral questions arose. What should I believe? When is God speaking to me? I can't take advice from a priest. It's got to come straight between me and God, and I'm not sure I'm hearing anything. Hamlet has read books. He's taken notes. The university supplied plenty of learning, but he's still left uncertain how to apply it. We see him remember one piece of learning. "What a piece of work is a man," he says. "How noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving how express and admirable, in action how like an angel, in apprehension how like a god, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust?" Now, the first part of that speech is orthodox Renaissance doctrine about man's exalted position in the world, midway between the angels and the animals. It sounds very much not like a German Protestant, but like an Italian philosopher, Pico della Mirandola, who wrote an oration on the dignity of man, a thing that Hamlet would well have read at Wittenberg. And yet, vividly though he expresses the doctrine, Hamlet no longer assents to it. "What to me is this quintessence of dust? To me, what is my particular position as a Protestant loner?" There is the lonely Protestant voice, full of lost idealism, nostalgia for the lost ideal. Now, Hamlet eventually does solve his problems. He solves them apparently on the boat to England. He discovers there that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are carrying a letter sentencing him to death by the hand of the King of England. He manages to forge a substitute and to make the substitute look genuine because he just happens to be carrying in his pocket the royal seal, his father's signet. That will authenticate the false orders. And then the pirate ship came along. The Danish ship engaged it in battle, and he was the only one who managed to get aboard the pirate ship, and he would be able to persuade the pirates to bring him back to Denmark. In other words, a series of accidents occurred having to do with the letter and his ability to forge and the seal and the pirates. And in that series of accidents, Hamlet finds the design of God. Even in this was heaven ordinant. Such a series of chances, clearly undirected by any human choice, any human plan, delivering him from a murder plot that he hadn't expected, and returning him to Denmark where he still had work to do, still had to confront the king, must indicate God's providence. Therefore, he believes, God governs all events. "We defy augury," he says to Horatio. "There is special providence in the fall of a sparrow. If it be not now, 'tis to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. Since no man of aught he leaves knows, what is to leave betimes? let be. We don't know when we're going to die. We do know that we will die. If it's now, okay, it won't come in the future. I don't have to fear about it in the future. If it isn't now, then I don't need to worry about what's happening now. It will come. Since we don't know enough about the world really to understand it, what does it matter if we leave it? Let be. Hamlet stops trying to control everything. That is one thing he'd been trying to do with all those intellectual explanations, control everything. Now, he says, let's leave it up to providence. There's a special providence even in so small a thing as the fall of a sparrow. He's quoting, of course, the Gospel according to Matthew. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And one of them shall not fall upon the ground without your father. Fear ye not, ye are of much more value than sparrows. God governs all events. Therefore, we do not need to seek explanations in such things as the theory of tragic flaw, according to Aristotle, or the theory of fortune, according to Boethius, or even in the theory, according to Isaiah, that God occasionally selects human agents as scourges and ministers. God governs everything. It's not a matter of occasional intervention. God provides all the opportunities. Hamlet need do nothing to set up the circumstances for his final revenge on Claudius. It happens that Claudius and Laertes have already worked out the whole plot about the duel and the poison. All Hamlet needs to do is take the opportunity when it presents itself. The readiness is all. And he is ready. Horatio expresses the fear that Hamlet will lose that duel to Laertes. Laertes is a notable swordsman. But Hamlet says, no, don't worry about that. I have been in continual practice since he went into France. He's kept up his swordsmanship. He's in good shape. He can take the opportunity when it offers himself. And so in the final scene, in a wonderful display of physical dexterity and moral perception and intellectual grasping the point, he dominates the scene, defeats Laertes, kills the king even in the act of killing others, and everything is plain to the audience around them. Everything is made known. He is ready, and the readiness is all. The tragedy of Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, is the drama of the Protestant conscience, led into doubt by the puzzlements of the world and the self, trying to amend that doubt with all the learning that antiquity and humanism can make available, and arriving heroically at his own convictions, and then acting on them. In a famous and influential book of criticism, Shakespearean Tragedy, A.C. Bradley announced in 1904 that the great Shakespearean tragedies were four: Hamlet, Othello, King Lear, and Macbeth. And that quartet has stuck with us as the top of Shakespearean tragedy. But even as he wrote that book, Bradley acknowledged that Othello was slightly different from the other three. Othello lacked the sense of huge natural or supernatural forces at work. What Hamlet does in the way of discovering providence, what Macbeth has in the way of witches and a sense of evil, the persistent questioning in King Lear about the nature of the gods. Othello operates on a scale closer to ordinary private life than do Hamlet, Macbeth, and King Lear. It does not involve the fate of a kingdom. Obviously, something is rotten in the whole state of Denmark in Hamlet. Macbeth concerns all of Scotland. King Lear concerns Britain and the universe as a whole. Even Romeo and Juliet involves the fate of Verona as a city. But with Othello, we do not have that sense. We could have had that sense. Othello begins with the great threat of the Turkish Empire to the Venetian Empire. And the Turks and the Venetians did divide the Mediterranean between them in the 16th century. We begin with the Senate and the Duke of Venice, a midnight meeting of the Senate in order to determine how to meet the Turkish threat. For people of Shakespeare's time, the Turkish threat was enormous. The Turks had been occupied not only the Eastern Mediterranean and what had been the Byzantine Empire, but all of the Balkans. They had been turned back only at the gates of Vienna. And a major sea battle in 1571, when Shakespeare was a child, the Battle of Lepanto, had saved the Western Mediterranean from invasion by the Turkish fleet. All that is of concern in the first and second act of Othello, but it all drops away. The value of the play lies in the individuality of the characters, the richness of their psychology, their psychic interplay, the clarity and concentration of the plot. It is the closest that Shakespeare wrote to domestic tragedy. There is a reason for this particular concentration, not only in the scope of the plot, but also in the structure of the play. How the action has been spread out over the five acts. Much that happens in Othello depends on the location of what you might call the tragic deed. That act that disrupts nature and disrupts the order of society and causes other bad things to happen in its wake. For Hamlet, that act had happened before the play began in Claudius's murder of his brother. In Macbeth, that act happens quite early in the play, in Act Two, when Macbeth murders King Duncan. In King Lear, it happens in Act One, when King Lear rejects his daughter's love and wrongly divides his kingdom. But in Othello, it happens the other way around. Nothing fatal, nothing irrevocable, nothing absolutely dreadful occurs until the very last scene of the play. The play has a sense of claustrophobia about it. You may feel that something dreadful is going to happen, but none of the characters knows that anything dreadful has happened until the very end. Othello's mind is corrupted by Iago, but we keep thinking that could be reversed. He could find out the truth. He hasn't yet done anything fatal in his state of delusion. It isn't until he murders Desdemona in the last scene that something fatal is done. And then it is so late that the characters have almost no time to reflect upon it. All they can do is respond in horror. It is characteristic of the last scene in Othello that we do not get big statements about the meaning of suffering. We just get exclamations about how terrible it is. Oh, monstrous act! Oh, villainy! Oh, thou Othello, what shall be said to thee? Or in one of the most expressive lines of the whole play, simply, oh, 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 which I cannot possibly act out of context. Confronted with Othello's murder of his wife Desdemona, the bystanding characters are in effect helpless. They merely register the shock of it or the pity of it. No one can do anything about it, either in a practical way or in an explanatory way. In fact, it is so terrible to them that it almost gives the sense of being obscene. At the ends of other plays, the bodies are displayed. when Lear's daughters die at the end of King Lear, Albany orders the bodies to be produced. When Hamlet dies, Fortinbras says, bear Hamlet's body to the stage. These are objects of honor that should be paid attention to. At the end of this play, the character left in charge, Lodovico, says, this object poisons sight. Let it be hid. And this object is the bodies of Desdemona, Othello, and Emilia on the bed, the tragic loading of this bed. Moreover, the facts with which we are confronted at the end of the play are utterly destructive ones. What is threatened in this play is a single thing, the love of Desdemona and Othello, the intense happiness these two have achieved with each other. Now, the welfare of the Venetian state, the order of the universe, do not hinge upon the individual happiness of this couple. But the couple themselves absolutely depend upon it. Desdemona is no longer a senator's daughter. She is Othello's fair warrior. Othello is no longer an independent man. When his love for Desdemona is threatened, he cries, Othello's occupation's gone. In other words, they have rewritten their own identities in total commitment to each other. It's a play about commitment. Their marriage is the most important thing about them. They have surrendered separate identities to be a couple. And their happiness together is completely and utterly destroyed by the play, wholly ruined, nothing preserved or rescued. That is, the stakes may be lower than in Hamlet or in Lear, but the effect is more intense and more painful. Even more painful because they don't only die. They are denigrated. The action of this play abuses Desdemona, and it degrades Othello. If we sympathize with these people, we are unrelievedly appalled at what happens to them. It's an extremely painful play. Therefore, if this is the effect to be achieved, it is of the utmost importance that Shakespeare make us feel the preciousness and the value of what Othello and Desdemona have achieved in their love for each other, in their personal happiness, before the trouble starts. Shakespeare must thoroughly create in poetry and in action, the thing that will be destroyed before setting about the tragic process of destroying it. Again, look at the design of the tragedy. The tragic deed, the smothering of Othello, of Desdemona, does not take place until the final scene. The tragic process, the corruption of Othello's mind to get him to the point where he will kill his wife, doesn't begin until the middle of the play, until Act 3. Not, in fact, until the end of Act 2 does Iago arrive at any kind of coherent plan about how he will work on Othello. And not until Act 3, Scene 3, does he begin actually to put it into motion. Instead, the opening half of the play is devoted to action that establishes positive values. The first two acts of the play, in fact, constitute a romantic comedy. Othello is a tragedy built on a comedy. And the comedy is given to us with great fullness. Hamlet may start his play already dressed in black. And Macbeth may enter his play with murder already in his heart. But Othello and Desdemona start off as lovers. And in Shakespeare, love is a wonderful thing. Love is right. And what is right is natural. The lovers in comedies are in tune with the forces of nature, the forces that renew life. And the naturalness of love often provides the warrant for lovers to sweep aside ordinary inhibitions, normal proprieties of behavior, restrictions put upon people by decorum in society. they move towards some fulfilling environment. In the actual comedies, they move out into a green world, into the Forest of Arden, into the wood outside Athens. And good dukes and good princes eventually bless and validate their love and sweep aside whatever law or other obstacle stands in their path. In the comedies, natural and uninhibited love is also sometimes irrational. Irrational in its choice of object. Whom we love is often beyond our control, and often a person whom our parents or other relatives think is unlikely, inappropriate. It's a spontaneous and instinctive matter. Most of the comedies, after all, do depend on love at first sight, and very frequently, Daddy says, no, I want you to marry somebody else. This produces ludicrous situations and temporary conflicts, but the conflicts are resolved and the situation ceases to be ludicrous and the choice of love is ratified. Comedies end with marriage. Marriage either promised and forthcoming or marriage actually celebrated by some sort of ceremony on the stage. And marriage celebrates the rightness, the naturalness, the goodness of love. Marriage is considered to be the completion that crowns the story of lovers. Thus, Shakespearean comedy places all the stresses that happen in a sexual relationship in the courtship period, before the actual wedding. It is silent about significant problems or changes of direction that may befall people who are already married to each other. It implies the fairy tale formula, they lived happily ever after. Now, I'm not saying that Shakespeare or the Elizabethans in general were stupid, that they assumed that married people have no difficulties. Of course they knew that married people have difficulties. They'd had this king, Henry VIII, who went through six wives, after all. But the form of comedy does not ordinarily encompass such matters. Here is a way to describe the uniqueness of Othello. It deals with a post-comic world. We have the comedy, but it's over by the end of Act Two. Then we go on with what can happen in a marriage. It appears to accept the assumptions of comedy, and then it exposes them as containing the roots of tragedy. In the comedy of the first two acts of Othello, we have an unlikely pair of lovers. Indeed, a pair that no one has thought possible, except they themselves. Everyone around them reacts with astonishment. Othello is middle-aged. He is a lifelong bachelor. He has lived a life of action, of wandering, and a military career. He is non-urban, he is foreign, and he is black. Desdemona is young. She is the daughter of a great senator, brought up in the expectation of a marriage. She is inexperienced, she is urban, she is native to the society of Venice, and she is white. And on stage, she is almost always blonde, to heighten the contrast. And we have the usual barrier figures, the blocking father, her father, the senator Brabantio, who is outraged and accuses Othello of having used charms and other medicines to bring about Desdemona's affection for her, for him. There is also a disappointed rival, Rodrigo, who tries to set up obstacles. And there's a villain, Iago. But there is a good duke. And the good duke hears the case. The Senate scene, that is the big scene of Act One, is a kind of trial scene, where for a moment, the pressing business that afflicts the Venetian Empire, the fact that the Turks are attacking and presenting a great danger, is set aside, and everybody decides, let us hear this case about whether Othello properly married Desdemona or not. Let us turn into a domestic court instead of the ruling body of the empire. It is discovered that this is a good thing. The Duke blesses the marriage. And nature herself seems to cooperate in blessing the marriage. The couple immediately have to set forth to Cyprus in pursuit of Othello's professional duties. They sail there. They have to go through a terrific storm, but the storm itself goes calm and allows them to arrive at Cyprus. The storm does one thing before it goes calm. It disperses those nasty Turks. Nature herself will take care of the enemy and let through the young lovers, or the young and middle-aged married couple, to their happiness on the island. I must add one more major thing to what Othello and Desdemona go through when this marriage is discovered in the process of Act 1 and 2. They survive not only storm and tempest and the investigation of the Senate and the blocking father and the disappointed rival. They survive vilification, misrepresentation, scandalous reports of what they are doing. These characters are introduced in a very bad light. Othello in the worst possible light. The opening conversation in the play is between Iago and Rodrigo, who dislike Othello very much. And they reveal the wedding, the elopement, to Brabantio, who is not happy about this news at all. And thus, in that opening conversation, long before we see Othello, we get a lot of description of him. And he's described as loving his own pride and purposes. We're told he talks in bombast, that he's done something terribly unfair about promoting Cassio over Iago's head when Iago really deserved the promotion. He's described as an extravagant and wheeling stranger. They suggest to Brabantio that Othello was really trying to rob him, to steal his wealth as well as his daughter. Brabantio suggests that Desdemona was corrupted by spells. And nastiest of all, the union between Othello and Desdemona is described in physical terms as being very unattractive. An old black ram is tupping your white hue. Your daughter is covered with a Barbary horse. Your daughter and the Moor are making the beast with two backs. Very unattractive descriptions of sexual intercourse. Bestial, disgusting, and designed to arouse all latent racial animosities. Your daughter is in bed with a black man. Now, we may be suspicious of some of these descriptions. We know that Iago dislikes the Moor when he says these kinds of things. But we are not in a position to contradict these descriptions until we see Othello himself. And then, when we see Othello himself, it turns out he's not like that at all. He is black. But he's not full of bombast. He's not extravagant and wheeling. He's not doing anything physically disgusting to Desdemona. He is very self-controlled. He is almost monosyllabic. He is princely, anything but bestial. He is magnificent. His first line is, "'Tis better as it is." Nothing could be more controlled. And when Iago says Brabantio has run off to the Senate to complain about you stealing his daughter and he's raising the utmost fuss, Othello says, let him do his spite. My services, which I have done the Signory, shall out-tongue his complaints. He's perfectly self-confident of himself and of his position in Venice. When Iago suggests, perhaps you better go back inside the inn and not be found here in the street, this might be a messy encounter, Othello says, no, I must be found. I mean, it would be ridiculous if the general were hiding indoors when there is disorder in the streets. And in fact, when there is disorder in the streets, Othello is able to quell it with a single line. Put up your bright swords, or the dew will rust them. He doesn't need to get out his own sword. It's just one line that cuts across the bright swords of the quarrelers in the street. Now, the courtship has been unusual, has been romantic. We are given a description of how Othello wooed her, unintentionally, simply telling the story of his life, and telling it without egotism, telling it with no emphasis on what he had achieved, simply about the interesting places he had been, of moving accidents by flood and field, of hairbreadth escapes in the imminent deadly breach, of being taken by the insolent foe and sold to slavery, of my redemption thence, and portage in my travels' history, where of Antra's vast and desert's idol, rough quarries, rocks, and hills whose heads touch heaven, it was my hint to speak. It sounds like there was more emphasis on the geography than what happened to him. There is a similar bit of misleading having to do with Desdemona, with the heroine. We don't see her either. And she is described by Brabantio as being shy and reclusive, blushing, a maiden never bold, of spirit so still and quiet that her motion blushed at herself. Sounds like a perfect little ninny. But actually, this girl who's supposed to be so shy and never bold stands up in the middle of the Senate at midnight and defends herself as having chosen her own husband, with self-possession, rationality, and grace. She says, "I owe you duty, Father. You begot me, you bred me, you raised me. But now I owe my lord Othello duty. So much duty as my mother owed you, I owe Othello." It's perfectly self-possessed, firm. It is neither scared nor gushy. She's not saying, "But Daddy, I love him." She knows exactly where she is. These are people in control of their own destinies. The final step in this two-act comedy of love is that the love is celebrated. It is given a full-throated, gloriously poetic celebration when they arrive on Cyprus. There is no wedding scene proper in this play. We do not see an actual marriage being celebrated. What we see is a carefully orchestrated procession whereby the people having to do with this wedding arrive on Cyprus, upon the island of Venus. Cyprus is sacred to Venus. It is the island of love. Shakespeare is most careful to arrange it. There are three ships bringing the Venetians to Cyprus. On the first comes Cassio. On the second come Desdemona, brought by Iago and Iago's wife, Emilia. On the third arrives Othello, so that we have a carefully graduated procession coming, with each group worried about how safe the group coming after them are, because there are still the tail ends of that storm around. This, as I say, is orchestrated as a kind of wedding scene. Othello and Desdemona are, of course, the bridal pair, and Emilia is attending on Desdemona as a kind of lady-in-waiting or matron of honor. Cassio is the best man. Cassio is the one who gets to say all the good things about how wonderful a couple these are, to make, as it were, the toast. And Iago is the guy there always is at a wedding, the guy who's over in a corner making dirty jokes about what really has been going on. Do you suppose she's pregnant? How long have they known each other? Is this going to be any good? There's always that cynic at weddings, usually sitting at the bar, drinking too much. But it's Cassio, as celebrator, as best man, that particularly interests me. He is singing what is called in 16th century poetry an epithalamion, a marriage song. Montano, who is on the island of Cyprus, who is the temporary governor there, asks him, "Good lieutenant, is your general wived? And Cassio answers, most fortunately, you know, with the greatest of good fortune, he is wived. He hath achieved a maid that paragons description and wild fame, one that excels the quirks of blazoning pens, and in the essential venture, in the essential vesture of creation, does tire the engineer. That is, this woman is so beautiful, she cannot be described by a pen, by a poet who would write about how beautiful this bride is. In the essential vesture of creation, she would tire the engineer, the ingenious poet. Well, my text, the Bevington text, has a note on that, saying, in her real beauty, she would outdo anyone who would inventively praise her. But I think the essential vesture of creation is more than in her real beauty. The essential vesture of creation is, of course, nudity. God created Eve naked. We were came into the world naked. It would tire the ingenious poet to describe her in her naked glory. She is as naked as Eve, or perhaps more relevantly, as naked as the goddess Venus. This is her island. She is coming to shore on it. She is like Botticelli's Venus, being blown ashore on Cyprus, washed ashore on the Mediterranean island. Venus risen from the waves, Venus Anadyomene. In fact, she is divine Desdemona in Cassio's next speech. The guttered rocks and congregated sands, traitors in steep to clog the guiltless heel, as having sense of beauty, do omit their mortal natures, letting go safely by the divine Desdemona. She is our great captain's captain, not only Venus Anadyomene, but Venus risen from the Venus Armata, Venus armed. The riches of the ship is come on shore. Ye men of Cyprus, let her have your knees. Hail to thee, lady, and the grace of heaven before, behind thee, and on every hand, and wheel thee round. The grace of heaven on all sides of her. Venus Anadyomene, Venus Armata, the Venus of Botticelli's Primavera, who has the graces of heaven around her, the three graces. Or perhaps even the Virgin Mary herself, and wheeled around by stars. Cassio is calling upon all these associations for this marvelous wedding poem, extolling the bride as a goddess. And Othello, too, as a god worth her. He is the Mars who will marry this Venus. And who comes to her, claiming her to be, oh, my fair warrior. And she responds, my dear Othello. And he goes on, it gives me wonder, great is my content, to see you here before me. Oh, my soul's joy. If after every tempest come such calms, may the winds blow until they've wakened death. And let the laboring bark climb hills of seas Olympus high and duck again as low as hells from heaven. If it were now to die, 'twere now to be most happy. He is so delighted he can scarcely believe this is happening. That moment of joy when you reach out toward the person you love and she reaches back and you can scarcely believe that the love is reciprocal. That you are together. This is a union totally celebrated, totally given to us, totally given to each other. The play depends on getting that established first.